Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 12th, 1995. In the Creekside Room this afternoon, our speaker is Jerry Pedersen, and he will be speaking on forgiveness, the cost of neglecting. Let's listen in.
I am Jerry Pedersen. This is second in a series on forgiveness. And today it may take the direction of what does it cost to neglect this gift. And as I told people, I recommend the little book, Forgive and Forget. By the way, it doesn't have an and. It's Forgive, Forget.
The and is there.
Oh, that's an and.
There it is.
You're so perceptive. But we shall be talking also the next day or two that forgiving is not forgetting. At least I'm going to suggest that. And it better not be forgetting.
The author?
Smeeds, S-M-E-D-E-S. I think it's $6.95 in the bookstore. And if you're going to go home and want to lead a discussion group, there's a leader's guide for it, which I didn't have before coming up. But this gives you all you need to know about leading a small group. Why is it they always write these after I get past using it? A passionate man was so in love for truth that he traveled to distant places in search for truth. Then one day at home, his wife told him how unfairly he was treating her, and she discovered that her husband had no interest in that kind of truth. It's the only kind of truth that matters, of course. And just to emphasize that this isn't so much about the ideas of forgiveness. You know, it's not a head trip about forgiveness. It's from our entire lives a commitment to participate in it. Anthony DeMello is a priest who writes some beautiful stuff. Anthony DeMello. And he has one book of little anecdotes and stories and stuff. One of them, he says, is an atheist fell down a steep cliff. And as he was falling, he caught hold of a branch, you know, and hanging there, he said, "God, God." And there was silence. And he waited a while. "God, if you exist, save me. And I'll promise to believe in you, and I'll even teach others to believe in you." He kept hanging on. Then he heard a voice. "Yeah, that's what they all say when they're in trouble." And he says, "No, no, God, no. I'm not like the others. Why, I've already begun to believe in you. And if you save me, I'll proclaim your name to the ends of the earth." "Well," the voice said, "okay then, very well, I'll save you. Let go of that branch." "Let go of the branch? Do you think I'm crazy?" Which, you know, forgiveness. Hey, sounds great, isn't it? But do you mean to say, actually, forgive this bum who hurt me and wronged me? Ah, that's another matter. And of course, until we're ready to take that risk, all your ideas about forgiveness, throw them out the window. And I must say, I've heard pastors and I've heard people talk about forgiveness who don't practice it or don't know the thrill, the joy, the power that comes in the life of forgiveness. In the library, Learning to Forgive, Doris Donnelly. Entomologically, what's the study of words? Entomology?
Etymology.
Entomology.
Can't pronounce those things. To forgive is an extended, expanded, strengthened, and empowered form of the verb to give. Experientially, it is those things too. This is an intriguing suggestion because to be fully alive and fully human is to be a giver. Precisely, to be one who gives love. That act of self-donation, all that I am, all that I have, appears deceptively simple at first until the ego defense mechanism set in and interfere with the process and distract us from pursuing a life of selfless love with zeal and single-minded fidelity. Then we sense resistance even to giving and recognize that simple aim as a lifelong task and a graced achievement. The question then boils down to, if giving is what it means to be human, what more can forgiving be? Well, she says, forgiving begins where giving ends. Forgiving begins where giving ends. Forgiveness assumes that the only gift worth giving is the self. But the condition of the self is different for the giver and for the forgiver. The forgiver is hurt, feels pain, anger, frustration, and hears a call still to remain open and giving. Then she gives an example, the difference between a giver and a forgiver. For example, I've been asked to a party being given by a coworker. My presence, my time, my donation toward a gift, all are called for and expected. I weigh the time factor, that's a conflict in my life, and the financial contribution I'm expected to give, that's a little bit of a strain in the pocketbook. But I am anxious to show my co-worker my admiration and esteem, and so I'm willing to shuffle my agenda and my budget and to be part of the event. That makes me a giver. Now consider the difference between that and the following. I've been asked to a party for a coworker who betrayed my confidence several years ago. The wounds of that relationship have never healed. Confidence and friendship were never restored. I am now asked to contribute my time, which I resent, and my money, the final insult, towards festivities for someone I'm not especially fond of. Isn't that a bit too much to ask? Yet in the middle of the conflict, I see that the party gives me a chance to re-examine and perhaps reintegrate my feelings. On the one hand, I can still admit the fact of the betrayal, and on the other hand, I can consider the party an invitation as a gesture towards possible reconciliation. I weigh whether I want that. I decide to stick my neck out and bend towards forgiveness and peace. I'll do my share towards burying the hatchet. That person is a forgiver. The forgiver is asked to put the pain aside after recognizing it and identifying it, to be other-centered by looking at the one seeking or in need of forgiveness, and not at his own or her own wound. The giver is asked to be generous. The forgiver is asked to be magnanimous and even heroic. The fact of the matter is that forgiveness is the only reaction which does not merely react, but acts anew and therefore freeing from its consequences both the one who forgives and the one who is forgiven. A devout man fell on hard times. And so he thought, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm going to pray and ask God for a favor. Not for anybody else's time, which I usually do. I'm going to ask it for myself. And so he prays for God, give me this favor which I'm asking for myself this sometime. I'm sure you won't say no. What I'm asking is, allow me to win the lottery. And then days pass, and weeks pass. The lottery passes. Another lottery is coming up, and he wants to say the same prayer. And so he asks, come on, God, give me a break. Why don't you hear me? Give me a break. Then he hears a voice from heaven. Give me a break yourself. Why didn't you buy a lottery ticket? How many people are just, groaning and hurt and pain and resentment and anger and frustration because they've been hurt or something? And we say, hey, come on, God, get me out of this mess. Well, the way to get out of the mess is to buy a ticket, or is the road of forgiveness. If you're not ready to run the risk of forgiving, and it's got all kind of risks to it, but only by that risk can you find the joy and the pleasure and the happiness of, the joyful, blessed life. Is it possible that all the horrible things you've done in your life have been forgotten by everybody except yourself? Is it possible that everybody else has forgotten all the terrible things you ever did? And maybe God's forgotten it. And you haven't. Self-forgiveness is probably the toughest and the hardest and the final thing to do. The truth that sets us free is almost always the truth we would rather not hear. Liberating truth, freeing truth. Hey, we don't want to hear it because that probably demands some kind of some change in our life or something on our part. Let me see if I should read this. If I have been profoundly hurt and my resentment is throbbing at the very bottom of this measure, I have only three alternatives. First, one, I could put a bandage on top of the wound, pretending that it's not serious, that it doesn't require any further attention. But wounds inflicted physically and psychically and spiritually bear comparison to physical wounds. And the process of their cure is similar. Splintered fingers that are not cleaned will not heal properly. In fact, if they're not taken care of at all, they can disfigure, they can fester, they can infect the total organism. A cut that is treated with a bandage when it requires more thorough medical attention may cause recurrent pain and take longer to heal, if in fact it heals at all. Or, second level, I can be led by the pain or the hurt. My interests, my actions, my choices will then be made in the light of the pain. And if you, as my friend, touch that pain, that wound, that hurt, accidentally or deliberately, you're going to set off a reflex action in me that allows me to relieve the original painful experience and to be led by it once again. Or the third level, I can allow forgiveness to inch its way down to the level of my pain. Forgiveness can extend even beyond the hurts that have been directing me so that eventually forgiveness commands. For instance, a young man rejected in a relationship forgives his former girlfriend and no longer is led then by that pain. A middle-aged man, depressed by feelings of inadequacy, forgives his father's relentless pushing him towards excelling and is able to be led by forgiving love rather than resentment. A wife is able to forgive herself for unreasonable perfectionism and can live an unshackled future. These transfers of power are occasions to rejoice because they mark the end of a fierce and innervating struggle and inaugurate the blessed peace of healing. In the Lord's Prayer, how do you interpret when Jesus says, "Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us"? Did I quote that right? What does that mean? Does that mean if we don't forgive, God doesn't forgive us? Does it mean? What's it?
That's what the prayer is.
That's what it says.
For we ask God to forgive us as we forgive others. And if we're not forgiving others, this is equals and it's all not God's fault.
Anybody argue with that? It's pretty reasonable to think that's the meaning. I guess we go on to say that God's forgiveness, grace, really precedes our own actions of forgiveness. But that's not what Jesus said. He did say, "Forgive us as we forgive others." And in other words, it is a command. And it's one that we ought to take pretty seriously. And it's ignored pretty generally. What's the Grand Commission, the Great Commission? Excuse me, a little louder.
You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself.
That isn't the answer I expected, but I think of that as a great commandment. I was thinking about the Great Commission, but hey, that's such a good answer. You get an A+. No, the last chapters of Matthew, the Great Commission, that.
Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel. Go ahead.
What?
Teaching. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, somebody else take a crack at it.
Go ye. Baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. But also
teaching them what he has commanded. And that part of it, I've got to forget.
Go into all the world and teach all that I've commanded you, and so on.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
No. It's not. Everybody says it that way. Teaching you all that I've commanded, and then on. But what Jesus says, teaching them to observe all that I commanded. Teaching them to do what I've commanded. It's not just to teach them to get a head trip, a bunch of information about what God commands or teaches. That's so often what we do. But it's teaching them to practice everything I've told and commanded. And forgiveness, of course, if you don't practice it, you can know everything. You can write books. And I know people that write great stuff, but who don't observe it, who do not practice it. And so the most critical thing about forgiveness is, I know people that don't really know much about, quote, forgiveness, but whose life is a steady, regular, daily practice of living a forgiven-related life. And that's what we're after. So, I would rather be a practicer of forgiveness than I would be one who tries to teach a course in it. When I started looking at this topic, I looked at all the passages about forgiveness, everything that the Bible has to say, and I was surprised about one thing. The Bible doesn't teach a lot about us and forgiveness of one another. There are things there, but there's not much. Almost everything that's in the scriptures is about God's forgiveness of us. It's almost totally that. And it's almost as if, hey, don't worry too much about what your obligations or responsibilities are. Or just know the fact, the reality of the love of God for you. Know the grace of God for you. And of course, respond to it. That's the key. The Christian insight is the response of our lives to what we know. Reuel Howell says, man's need, God's action. The full blessing of the Spirit is to know love through the gift of Christ, and therefore to love others. The full blessing of the Spirit is to know through Christ to be forgiven, and therefore forgiving. The full blessing of the Spirit is to be reconciled, and therefore reconciling. The full blessing of the Spirit is to be loved, and therefore loving. And to get into understanding what forgiveness is about from a Christian point of view is to, you know, is to learn and practice and resonate and experience. One of the first Bible verses I ever memorized. I remember getting some stars because I memorized, "We love because he first loved us." And I selected that one because it only had five words. The first one I selected was
Jesus wept.
Only two words. You did it too, huh? Oh, boy. Start wherever you are, folks. One of the things that I went to, Al Lane is a Swedish theologian, wrote the book, The Faith of the Christian Church, and I found this very helpful. He talks about forgiveness in theology and in scriptures being an intimate relational word and not a judicial related word. And I'll try to point out the distinction in this. In the judicial appreciation of it, and there is some New Testament references to forgiveness as a judicial concept. We'll talk about that in a moment. Forgiveness does not simply imply a remission of punishment. This is judicial. As long as the relationship between God and man is conceived in judicial terms, the question is principally about acquittal and freedom from punishment. The law is the only connecting link between the judge and the accused. They have no personal connection with each other. The question is only whether the accused can be acquitted according to the law. Even if a pardon is granted, it need not imply a more intimate personal relationship between the accused and the presiding judge. What happens is simply that the punishment is remitted and the accused is set free. Any of you ever been in a trial or law, you know, where you stood before the judge and you were going to be given some kind of a judgment? I have. What happens when, surely some of you had traffic fines, haven't you? When people, you know, they get the judge telling them what, you know, your fine is $75. The person walks out. What does the person usually say? What's the reaction when people pay a fine?
I thought it was going to be.
It isn't as much?
Yeah.
Gee.
Yeah.
Wow, you must have different courts than the ones I have. Ah. I've usually heard, whoa, $150 for that thing. Wow, that was, or I even deny that I was going that fast, or I didn't deserve it. In fact, I contested one of my tickets one time. And by the time they got to me, there must have been 25 other people. Every one of them got up there and said, Judge, I really wasn't going that fast, or I really hadn't been drinking that much, or it wasn't as bad as they claim, or the officer wrote it down right. And by the time I got up there, I thought, gee, I don't want to even say what my argument is, because after listening to these, all these others all sound exactly the same way, even though I thought I had a good one. But let me tell you an experience I had when I was in Africa. I was at the University of East Africa in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And it was it's a four-year liberal arts school. They had the school for East Africa for law, medicine being in Kampala, Uganda, and engineering, technology being at Nairobi in Kenya. But then in addition to this school, they had special courses. And they had one for magistrates. This was in the School of Law. And these magistrates were now called magistrate. We'd call them judges. But very few of them had any kind of formalized education. Most of them, and you know, the country had become independent just a couple years before this, and they were setting up some kind of westernized ideas of law courts. And they'd take this old wise man, the MZ, the wise man out of the little tribe, and he's now the judge. He's the magistrate. And then they would bring them to Dar to give them 6 or 8 weeks of specialized training to try to upgrade their educational experience. And they would listen to these learned professors, most of them from Europe, maybe East Germany or Russia or United States, wherever they were from, that teach them our Western concepts of law. And then I was asked to go in and have a week or two of specialized teaching, and this just came out of practical experience. And I put together a course that combined sociology and psychology and little theology, which I didn't call that. And just practical stuff, and they ate it up. It's the first time they'd ever had anything like this. But one of the things I discovered from these magistrates was they all kind of laughed behind their backs at how we practice law in the West. They said, from everything they teach us, all they're interested in determining is, are you guilty or not? If you're not guilty, you go free. If you're guilty, you pay a fine, and you walk out. He said, that's not how we practice law. He said, out in the village, the purpose isn't to find out whether somebody's guilty or not. Obviously, somebody's guilty. Maybe both people are guilty. But that's not our concern. Our concern is reconciliation. Our concern is that we be a clan, a tribe, that we be a unity, we be a family. And in one sense, we don't even care who's guilty. Oh, they do, yes, they do. But the purpose is not to determine if somebody's guilty or not. The purpose is to reunite these factions, because the one thing African life cannot handle is separation or division. I mean, they are a family, whether it's what we think of as a family, or a family of 25 people, or a family of 1,000. I had a man that worked for me, and we paid him a pittance, although it was about half again as much as all the other foreigners were paying, and they were constantly complaining that we were paying our man too much because, you know, we were ruining the system. But to save some money, because he had a special goal. And I'd say, well, how are you coming, Lucas, on saving money? And he'd say, well, I was doing pretty good, but then my brother came to town. And he needed car fare, and then he needed bus fare to get back to his village. And he said, so I'd give him money. And then a couple weeks later, I'd see another person out there with him and eating his food and all. I'd say, well, who's this, Lucas? Well, it's my brother. Or my sister came to town. I met 15 or 20 of these people. And I kept, Lucas, how big a family you got? And he said, whoa, I don't know. And he said, maybe a couple hundred? Everybody in his clan was a brother or a sister. And if you have something, you share it with them. You don't, you know, hey, they're your brother. One day, he had this lovely watch, and he didn't have it. And I asked, Lucas, where's your watch? He said, well, my brother was here, and he was going back to our home village. It was up about 150 miles up country, and he didn't have a watch, and he thought it would really help him, so I gave my watch. And I could halfway have strangled the guy, because, you know, well, a conclusion I came to was that we Americans know a lot about individualism. We're individualists. We know a lot about it. Africans know a lot about community. We know almost nothing about community. They don't know much about individualism. And we could do something for them by contributing their sense that, you know, who you are is not just part of a community, you're a person within that. If you ask, in Tanzania in those days at least, if you ask an African, and who are you? He'd say, I'm a Karambi, or I'm a blanked out names, Ubano. I'm a people, I'm a tribe. That's who I am. And, you know, well, what's your name? Well, well, I'm Lucas. Or I'm, their individual name was secondary to their community name. They needed a little dash of Western individualism. But boy, we need a whole dosage of African communalism. I learned what a congregation was when I was there. You know, it's a group of people together. It's a family worshiping together. I come back to California. Congregations are, if there's 500 people in it, we got 500 individuals. There's almost no communal aspect of that. It's a bunch of separated people who come together like a bag of marbles and who leave, you know, not touched to one another. How did I get off onto this? I was telling about this session with magistrates in this speed up court. These magistrates would say, our purpose when we have a trial out there in the bush is to restore the unity of the tribe or the clan or the group. And he said, when we finally have heard and you listen and everybody talks and everybody shares their insight, it may take a long time to get on. Nothing happens fast. It takes time. But finally they've heard all the signs and the wise man, the magistrate, says, well, this is my finding. And he finds, you know, you were at fault. And you're going to have to pay a penalty. You're going to have to give two counts to this offended party, or you're going to have to, give a bushel of corn, or maybe they have some monetary and they're going to have to pay something. But that isn't the end of it. The fellow who receives the payment, he throws a party. And the guilty party comes to it, and all his brothers and sisters and the clans, and they have one big rousing party. And in African life, a party isn't just, a little half an hour shindig. It's liable to be a night or two of dancing and playing of drums and all kinds of joyous activity. Because the important result of African law is to restore the unity of the tribe.
Can we get them to come over?
Yeah.
Magistrates?
Hey, you got it, boy. You got it. No.
It's too bad they can't do that intertribally, though, between Mike and Rhonda and those places.
Well, yes, now you're talking about. Things have been thrust so fast on the African. We're expecting them to do in a generation or two or three what took Western civilization centuries to do. And in the process, industrialization has to take place, all the written languages and formalized education, all these things. And it doesn't happen that fast. So that the experience of most traditional African life, they learned how to heal, this healing process and all, to their clan or their tribes. But now suddenly we have nations that have been created. And these nations are totally arbitrary things that don't fit the natural experience of the African. It doesn't recognize, they say, this line here is going to be Tanzania. Now, half of the Maasai, for instance, are in Kenya, and half of them are in Tanzania. And so the reality for the Maasai tribesmen, all their customs, everything is built up to maintain that tribal unity. Suddenly, bling, a nation has been created, not by Africans, but by colonial powers sitting in London or France or Versailles or someplace to create this nation. And so they've been thrust into this nation state suddenly. And the old mechanisms aren't working very well for them. It's too bad they have this intertribal rivalry and all that.
I mean, that could work between any groups, including the whole world, for that matter. Instead of having only.
But I have to ask this: what happens if you get one African tribesman who insists on a win-lose, who has a Western viewpoint? It seems to me that the whole system depends on everybody having the same point of view and the same model for conflict resolution. And all you need to wreck it is to drop one person in who decides they want to win or lose, and that falls apart.
I'm trying to make a point here that's got a beautiful point to it. Don't bring up too many complications for me, will you? Sure.
Well,
of course, we in the West have a good record of solving our conflicts.
Right.
Yeah, we haven't done those terrible things that Rwandans and all the others done. Oh yeah, we had a little atomic bomb. And, oh yeah, we had mass saturated bombings. And, oh yeah, we subverted the governments of almost every Central American country with our Contras. Oh, but we were the good guys in that. Yeah. Well, what I'm getting at in this is that I told of this African incident to try to illustrate a point that Alain is making theologically, that if you use the judicial model, where the question of who's guilty and what's the punishment, we've missed the entire thrust of what Christian theology is all about. Incidentally, I have never been able to make sense out of one of the biblical teachings about how we're reconciled to God, the ransom concept of the atonement. You know, we sinned against God. Somebody has a debt to pay. We're the sinners. We have a debt to pay. And Jesus died so that we don't have to pay that debt. And that's a judicial concept. And for me, it just misses the whole point of what reconciliation is all about. He goes on to say it's a quite different situation when it is a question about a purely personal relationship, for example. A friend's relation to a friend or a child to his father. When these relationships are disturbed, the question is not simply whether legal action is to be taken and punishment meted out, but what is at stake now is the elimination of that which separates and threatens to destroy these old ties of affection. The question is whether the former confidential and intimate personal relationship can be reestablished and continued anew. This can be done in only one way: forgiveness. The judicial categories prove to be inadequate when it is a question of interpreting the inner character of the relationship to God. Almost all of us, when we think about forgiveness, are thinking about personal relationships. And really, we don't really care. I mean, who's guilty and what the penalty is, and that's irrelevant, really. The real concern is, how do you reestablish the unification of what at one time was close and meaningful and personal and terribly important? And who cares who's guilty? You know, the penalty or the punishment, that's beside, how do you restore? And that's what we're after when we study this whole idea of forgiveness. The principal danger is that forgiveness might be interpreted negatively as simply a remission of punishment. Such an interpretation is not satisfactory, does not exhaust the rich content of the idea. The essential element is the positive reestablishment of the broken fellowship. Luther, in his when he goes to the catechism, when he talks, he uses the word forgiveness over and over and over again, and he pours into it the positive significance that says, where there is forgiveness of sins, there is life and salvation, or life and blessedness. Or it isn't, you know, that some penalty has been paid and punishment has been extended, and now everything is legal again. No, it's rather because there's forgiveness, now that which was dead is alive. That which was stifled and a dead-end street in their life, now there's unification. There's the joy of restored fellowship. I'm going to just read this a little bit and see what you think about it. Alain says, God's act of forgiveness is inseparably connected with humans' remorse and penitence. Do you believe there has to be penitence before God forgives? Tell me more about that. Anyone?
No, but if there's not penitence, we do not accept the forgiveness. We do not experience the forgiveness. We are not freed by the forgiveness. It doesn't have that meaning for us until we have repented.
Yeah.
Is that good enough for you?
Yeah, me too.
Gosh, all you people get A's. I was teaching a session, something like this up here a couple years ago. I had a pastor just take exception to what I was saying. There can be no forgiveness until there's repentance on our part. We're going to talk more about that, this particular thing later, but Arlene says, however, forgiveness is not dependent on remorse and penitence in the sense that there are causes, that they are the causes of the divine act of forgiveness. On the contrary, penitence is created by forgiving love. Forgiveness becomes the regenerative power in human life, in relationships. I was in seminary. I just got my doctorate, and I was planning to go into campus ministry, and they grabbed me and somehow wanted me to go to one of our Lutheran seminaries. So I tried it for a short time. And I got into a big argument with the professor of systematics. I didn't know I was getting into it. He didn't either. The students they'd come to class and they started asking questions. Answer the question, you know. Well, come to find out, they were asking questions of the systematics guy too. And he was making the case, and I guess the case was basically that law precedes the gospel. Law precedes grace. First, you got to convince the sinners of their sin, and then you offer the grace of Christ to them. And in all kinds of ways. And I was teaching a course in education, and I was saying, you have to treat people with acceptance, you have to treat people with grace, and then they finally feel strong enough and free enough to recognize what's wrong with themselves, and they start telling themselves, well, gee, if I'm loved this way, I've got to respond lovingly. Grace precedes law. And I believe it's a principle of education. I think families, you know, you love your kids, and they feel secure in it, and they feel wanted, and then there are certain things you as a family do. You know, you keep rules, you keep commandments, you live right. But you do that because, you want to do the family thing. It's the response of a loving family. At least this, I remember one time my son came home from kindergarten. And Drew was all upset. The teacher had called. It was about the third week of school. And she said, your son is just playing havoc in kindergarten. He upsets. He does everything wrong. When I tell the kids to stand, he sits down. And when you tell him to sit down, he stands up. And he's talking when he's not supposed to. She said, do you think you could do something about that? Drew, she was crying. And how are we going to handle this with our kid, you know, Scott? And so I said, well, let me think about it. A little while, I said, well, Scott, I'd like to see you up in my study. And Drew said, can I come along? And so she came along, and, you know, it's kind of a formal setting. I sat there, he sat there. I said, Scott, in our family, we're so proud to go to school and have people think well of us. We always cooperate with our teachers. That's what Pedersons do, you know? And we never try to create problems for the teacher. I understand you've been having a few problems with your teacher. Scott, that's not the way we Pedersons do it. Got that straight? He said, yeah. I said, okay, go on. That was all I said. Dirk said, aren't you going to say something more? You know? I said, no, I think that's all we need. Do you know, we talked to the teacher a week later, and she said, what did you do? And I think love always, appreciation is always more powerful than judgment. Somebody read this on the board up here.
Forgiveness is making the choice to release the person who has wounded us from the sentence of our judgment, however justified that judgment may be.
This is just a great definition of forgiveness in my judgment. I see. We only have a short time, haven't we?
Yeah, but you started like your hour, if you're doing an hour.
Did we start it? We start at 3:45.
Well, not by my clock either.
But my time, I see that. Well, we're gonna have to end here.
But if you're doing it, I'll tell you why.
Well, forgiveness is making the choice. It is a choice. It's not a natural thing to do. The natural thing is to react with anger, bitterness, you know, hit back, fight. But forgiveness is a choice to release the person who has wounded us from the sentence of our judgment. I like this. They've wounded me. They've hurt me unjustly, unfairly. I have a right to make a judgment about them, haven't I? Hey, they were unfair. But forgiveness is to release them from that judgment, to put that judgment and throw it out, even though the judgment may be justified. It probably is justified. I mean, it's correct. They were unfair. They were unreasonable. They were wrong. They betrayed. They didn't act as the confidant or the friend or whatever it was. But it's the choice to release them from my judgment, or that judgment, even though it's deserved. I think that gets at the heart of what forgiveness is. And not to do so, and this I hope to talk about more tomorrow along the way, not to do so is not to create a new relationship to the one that I have a judgment against. But even more, it's for me to continue in this angered hurt. I've been sinned against, I've been hurt. Not to release them is to confine myself as a prisoner of that action. I become a prisoner. I've become a prisoner of something that somebody did to me. They acted in a certain way or said something. And I'm going to be stuck now on what somebody else did, instead of taking the initiative to make a choice, to make a new and fresh response. Is to say, wait a minute, I'm not going to react to that way. I'm going to act as a person. I'm going to make a choice. It's not natural. You could even say, nobody can command me to do it. But I'd be a sucker not to, because if I don't, not only are they alienated from me, but I'm so stuck in this, you know, in this crap of a broken relationship. And it's going to fester, and it's going to hurt, and it probably is going to get worse. And I may gradually let it slide away, but the scabs and the sores are there. And so, the point I'm going to try to take, in one sense, don't worry about whether the person is worthy of my forgiveness, or whether they've earned it, or whether they're sorry, or whether they've repented. In one sense, don't worry about them. Now, I'm not saying that, but for the love of God, be selfish. For your own good, for your own happiness, for your own joy, get that monkey off your back.